The government's official report on the financial crisis is in.
What does it say? And why does it matter?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hello from American Public Media. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This morning at the American Public Media World Headquarters in St. Paul, Minnesota, you're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Thursday, January 27th. Coming up, Japan's credit rating takes a hit.
And Congressman Dennis Kucinich takes a pit, an olive pit, to the tooth. And now he's suing.
But first, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission released its official report today on what led to the financial crisis. Well, at least the Democrats on the commission released that report. Republicans didn't endorse the report. It says the crisis was avoidable and that there's blame to go around. Regulators, bankers, politicians, and credit rating agencies.
So let's start our coverage now with Marketplace's Elisa Roth, who is joining us from New York. Good morning, Elisa.
Good morning.
We've all talked about the crisis, obviously. What's new in this report?
Well, the book talks a lot about how much people get paid. On the one hand, there's the fact that the regulators had trouble recruiting finance people to work for them because, newsflash here, Wall Street pays so much better than the government. The other issue, though, is the idea that the way pay was structured actually encouraged people on Wall Street to take really big risks. I talked to Andrew Oranger this morning. He works on compensation issues at the law firm Ropes & Gray.
I think there is a concern that the incentives in the compensation systems did not align the interests of the institutions with the interests of the individuals.
In other words, the person making the deal would still get paid even if he or she were putting the bank at risk.
So, Elisa, will this report actually have any effect?
In terms of legislation, a lot of that was already passed with the financial reform bill. But a lot of how it'll actually work in real life still needs to be figured out. I talked to Matt Slaughter this morning. He's Associate Dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, and he says it's things like...
What data are going to be monitored about financial companies, how particular aspects of the law will actually be implemented, and what that'll mean for the practice of the individual firms and the overall financial system.
And for all of those issues, it'll be really useful to understand what caused the crisis.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth reporting from snowy New York City this morning. Elisa, thanks.
You're welcome.
Let's get reaction now from Diane Swank. She's chief economist with Mesirow Financial, and she's with us from Chicago. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
So what's the most interesting thing to you in this report?
Well, of course, there's blame for everyone from Wall Street to Washington, lots
right.
of witch hunts out there. But the most interesting thing is what's not in the report, and that's the dissents. And that is that this crisis was not just U.S. in nature. It doesn't have just Wall Street and Washington to blame. It was global in scope. It happened everywhere. And that is really important because if we don't take that into context, we'll be coming up with the wrong answers as we try to enforce the regulations that we're now trying to implement as a result of the financial crisis.
The dissents, you're talking about the Republicans on the commission who did not endorse what the Democrats came out with in this report. Diane, while we're talking politics here, I mean, financial reform already passed through Congress, was signed by the president. So what's the point of this report at this point?
Well, what's important is that the financial reforms left a lot of leeway for how regulators are going to actually enforce their regulations, how they're going to go about regulating the financial services industry and many industries, even beyond financial services. So to the extent that they have a lot of leeway, this report could influence and could have them over-regulating in areas where some people want to place too much political blame and missing areas where we still need to look closer at.
Diane Swank, chief economist at Mesirow Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And for one more take, let's head to Davos, Switzerland, where the World Economic Forum is taking place. That's where we find Simon Johnson of MIT. Good morning.
How are you?
Great. So this report from the FCIC says the financial crisis was avoidable. No big surprise there. Is there anything that caught your eye in what you've seen so far?
Not particularly. I think it's a good report. It's pretty balanced. And it does say that the regulators were responsible. And of course, I would add, they've not fixed the problem since then.
All right. Well, this was supposed to be like the report, the official report that came after the Great Depression. But a lot of people think that this report has come too late because financial reform already passed. What do you think?
There's a fantastic book on the Pecora hearings, the 1930 hearings, by Michael Perino
right.
called The Hellhound of Wall Street. And if you go through there, you see it was much more prosecutorial. There was much more revelation of sordid details than we've got this time around. And, of course, the legislation followed the Pecora hearings rather than preceding it, as in this case. So I'm afraid we're probably going to have to come back and do more reform again.
And Simon Johnson, finally, you're in Davos, Switzerland. There was just a call there today for less regulation on financial firms. Is it just a parallel universe over there?
Yes, I knew it was a parallel universe and I wanted to observe it, but I'm just shocked by the temerity of these bankers. Not only are they showing no remorse, they're saying, oh, that was all that regulation that you've introduced or tried slightly to push on us is irrelevant or bad or dangerous and damaging, and you should let us out of our box now. And the rest of the Davos elite seems to be buying into this. It's quite extraordinary and rather disturbing.
Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the IMF, thanks so much for talking with us this morning.
My pleasure.
Foreclosures in this country fell in half of the biggest metro areas. That's according to real estate data from RealtyTrack's year-end foreclosure report. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look.
When I first saw the RealtyTrack report, I thought, hey, things are looking up. Foreclosures in Southern California's major cities fell by at least 17%. Las Vegas, down 7%. Then I talked to Rick Sharga, senior vice president of RealtyTrack.
We can't interpret too positive a spin on that just yet.
Sharga says foreclosure rates only fell because of artificial forces. Some banks declared a moratorium on foreclosures after the scandal over shoddy paperwork. Sharga says others are just too busy to launch any new foreclosures.
The lenders and servicers may just be stuffed to the gills with distressed properties already on their books and already in the foreclosure pipeline.
One bit of genuine good news: Sharga says loans made in the last year or so have a less than 1% chance of foreclosure, so things should stabilize once we get through the backlog. But Sharga doesn't expect that to happen until 2013. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
So there's this big battle brewing in Dallas, Jeremy, for Super Bowl 45. We're not just talking about the Steelers and Packers, right?
Oh.
City and cab drivers are fighting over a policy that allows natural gas taxis to cut in line at one of the city's airports. This is Love Field, one of a big Southwest hub, right, in Dallas.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the city says the policy is a way to fight air pollution, but regular gas cabbies are threatening a big boycott. And that leads me to believe, Jeremy, that's going to help fight pollution even more, don't you think? If the cabbies stay parked.
Keep the air clean.
That's right. You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, January 27th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in St. Paul, Minnesota this morning. Now let's get to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world.
A piece of surprising bad news today for Japan. The ratings agency, S&P, has slashed that country's so-called long-term credit rating. It's basically a national credit score, and it could have repercussions in this country. The BBC's Roland Burke is in Tokyo with the latest. Hi, Roland.
Hi.
Japan seemed to be staying out of trouble after the recession. Why does S&P think it's in trouble now?
Well, the problem with Japan is its debt is already approaching 200% of GDP, far bigger than a country like the United States. And its deficit, the amount it's adding to that debt, is very high too. And what S&P is saying is that they don't believe Japan's going to be able to bring that down over the next 10 years. Essentially, the problem in Japan is this. The country is getting older. The country's population is declining. So there are fewer people to save. So the debt might become unsustainable.
Could this affect the global recovery, Roland?
In the short term, no. What might happen is Japan has to pay a bit more to borrow. But in the long term, some people here and abroad think that Japan could be an accident waiting to happen, that it could one day reach a tipping point. And this, of course, is the world's third biggest economy. So if that happens, if Japan goes the way of Greece, for example, that would have a massive effect on the world.
And why should Americans keep an eye on this? Is this going to help or hurt our economic future here?
Well, any problem for Japan is a problem for the United States, because Japan is second only to China in terms of its gold reserves and its foreign exchange reserves and things like U.S. treasuries. So what happens in Japan does really affect the United States.
The BBC's Roland Burke in Tokyo. Roland, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's get back to Davos, Switzerland now, where the World Economic Forum is underway. Today, a senior executive from Goldman Sachs made headlines there after warning that tougher bank regulation could trigger the next financial crisis. Tougher bank regulation could trigger it. Let's bring in our European correspondent, Stephen Beard, for more on this. Stephen, too much regulation? Most of the economists we talked to would say the last financial crisis happened because there wasn't enough regulation.
Right. Well, the argument is that if the regulators crack down too hard on banks, they'll push some of the bank's riskier investment banking activities out towards hedge funds and other bodies that are much less well-supervised, much less transparent. So Goldman Sachs says there could be all sorts of shenanigans. This could be the recipe for the next financial crisis.
And how is this going over in Davos?
Well, quite well, amid all the sort of high-price schmoozing in Davos. Outside the Swiss ski resort, I'm not quite so sure. Sean Rickard is a business economics expert at the Cranfield School of Management. He says the big banks are trying to wriggle out of their responsibility for the financial crisis, and he's worried that governments haven't already cracked down much harder on the banks.
Some of these large banks almost brought the whole system down. It caused no end of economic hardship for people. And still we're humming and hawing about whether and what sort of regulations we ought to put in train.
These remarks in Davos, Jeremy, you know, they are a clear sign of a recovering confidence of the bankers. I mean, last year and the year before, bankers were rather subdued in Davos, a bit shamefaced. Now it's clear that with surging profits and bonuses, they've got a bit of a spring in their step again.
My, how things are changing. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
Well, among hundreds of corporate and political leaders in Davos, Harvard University economics professor Kenneth Rogoff is there. He was part of a workshop looking at global trade and currency battles. Kenneth Rogoff, welcome to Marketplace. Good morning.
Good morning.
Is the global economy out of the woods? Is it time to, you know, start concentrating on reducing debt rather than getting some stimulus to the economy?
Well, I think the recovery has reached a point where it's resilient but not robust. It happens like day follows night. You have a big financial crisis around the world, and a few years later, you start seeing countries default on their debts. But it's usually been an aftershock and not enough to shake off the recovery. But it's one of the reasons the recovery is not as robust as we're accustomed to.
Would you agree that this recovery is jobless? And if so, what good is a recovery at all if there aren't jobs?
Well, there are jobs. It's just slower. When you have a deep financial crisis, things are much worse for a couple of years afterwards, sometimes even three or four. That's what we're seeing. It could have been a lot worse. People forget that. We could have had a second Great Depression. We didn't. But the situation with the jobs is probably going to heal only slowly because we're growing, but we're not really growing briskly.
I want to talk about China sending its largest delegation there to Davos. It's obviously been criticized by this country and others for its stance on what some see as the undervaluation of the UN. What prospects do you see for resolution of this problem? Is it ever going to come to a head?
Not tomorrow. It's certainly not. I mean, the Chinese are very reluctant to do anything quickly. I think our trade issues with China are much broader than that. They include also intellectual property rights. As I understand it, the Chinese president came to the United States with promises like the government will not use counterfeit software anymore, as opposed to trying to enforce property rights around the whole private sector. So it's really a gradual thing, and everyone agrees they should do it. The leaders don't want to do it. It's happening very, very slowly.
Kenneth Rogoff, economist at Harvard University. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
The text of the free trade agreement being hammered out between the U.S. and South Korea has been finalized, and officials hope to sign the deal sometime next month. President Obama says it'll help boost U.S. exports. Well, on that score, let's check up on something the president said not this week in the State of the Union, but last year in his State of the Union address. He said, Steve, you may remember, he wanted to double U.S. exports in 5 years.
Remember that? Yeah, famously.
Well, our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has this report now on how things are going.
Thanks to strong economic recoveries in developing countries, U.S. exports rose 17% during the first 11 months of 2010. John Murphy at the Chamber of Commerce says trade is the one bright spot for companies right now.
The U.S. consumer is struggling with debt. The housing crunch is also sapped demand domestically. That means that you're pretty much left with foreign demand.
To encourage more exports, President Obama called on lawmakers to approve pending free trade agreements with Colombia, Panama, and Korea. But those deals are stalled in Congress. Clyde Prestowitz was a trade official in the Reagan administration, and he says over time, Congress has grown skeptical of the economic benefits of trade agreements.
In the wake of each one of these deals, the U.S. trade deficit has gotten bigger, and the U.S. job creation has not been what was projected.
Plus, labor unions worry that freer trade with emerging markets will undermine salaries and working conditions in this country, and some companies resist competing with waves of cheaper imports. With opposition like that, the president may have to reach his export goal without new trade agreements. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, January 27th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in St. Paul, Minnesota. Whatever city we're in, Steve and I are always on Twitter. I'm at Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm at Radio Chio. New York State has taken over the finances of Nassau County on Long Island after that county failed to pay its bills. That might become a familiar story in the coming days as states and cities all over the country deal with huge budget gaps.
But some places are taking interesting approaches to their debt problems. Our economics correspondent Chris Farrell is with me here in St. Paul with more. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
So it's not all cut, 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 Chris. There are other things going on?
Look, that's the headline, and those cuts are big. People are losing their jobs, renegotiating contracts. But beneath the surface, I think the mantra is going to be innovation, innovation, innovation.
In what way? Have you looked up and found a specific example of that?
Okay, so if you go to West Des Moines, this is in some sense an old example, but we're going to see a lot more of it. 10 years ago, outsourcing trash hauling. They learned over the past 10 years when they renegotiated the contract. They put in that learning experience. But more importantly, the contract is now being run by a regional agency, and that's a greater efficiency, freeing up staff to do other things.
Greater efficiency, that's one thing. What else is going on?
Well, let's go to Maynard, Texas. And it's sort of the epicenter of .gov. You've heard this expression, or as I prefer, government by tweet. And everyone's trying to tap into the power of social media. What does the citizen know? Perhaps you see something that needs to be repaired. You know, you upload it, get that photo off to the Department of Public Works. It's an intriguing idea.
But sending a photo off to the Department of Public Works, that's not going to reduce a multi-million dollar deficit.
Well, this is where you're going to hear a lot over the coming year about clusters.
Okay.
So clean tech in Colorado is a classic example with this new governor. President Obama, when he gave his talk, State of the Union Address, talked about innovation.
Yeah.
Well, clusters are, you have something in your region where you have a strong business presence. Lots of suppliers, universities, lots of knowledge. This is where you're going to concentrate your resources, is bipartisan, is going to grow.
Put everyone together in the same place. And it's nice to be together this time right here with you in St. Paul. Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
From the real economy to the growing virtual one, Facebook will soon require all app developers to use Facebook's own credit system when selling virtual goods. So, for example, if you want to buy a new pig at Farmville, you pay with credits that you buy from Facebook. And Facebook, well, it takes a 30% cut. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports from Silicon Valley.
Justin Smith just published a report on this industry called Inside Virtual Goods.
Our estimate for the size of the U.S. virtual goods market is that it will hit $2.1 billion in 2011.
Smith thinks more than half of all these purchases will take place on Facebook. So by forcing all game developers to use its own virtual currency, Facebook will collect $300 million in fees next year from U.S. consumers alone. And Deb Liu, who runs this business for Facebook, says social games are just the beginning.
We see a lot of different options for Facebook credits in the future. Right now, social games is where a lot of this virtual economy is happening, but we see new verticals emerging, and we hope new verticals will emerge to use credits in the future.
Think of how much you already buy that's digital, your music, your media. All this could be delivered through Facebook and bought with its own corporate currency. So will the Facebook credit rival the U.S. dollar one day for economic dominance? Randy Krosner, a former Fed governor, doesn't think so.
When it's just within Farmville and people are using it for purchasing and selling cows and nothing more, that's no different than monopoly money. But if people are actually transferring credits to buy real goods and services,
that's a different story. The Facebook credit could get there one day, But for now, it has its limits. While you can use cash from 15 different countries to buy Facebook credits, there's no way to turn those credits back into real money. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, to Washington and a very high-profile lawsuit that's happening there. Former presidential candidate and current Congressman Dennis Kucinich is suing the congressional cafeteria.
Mm.
So turns out he bought a sandwich wrap, and then he bit into it, and he ended up biting into an olive pit.
Ow.
And injuring his tooth. Yeah, you've done that, but I've done that before.
I have done that before. Absolutely.
All right. Well, his lawsuit says the sandwich wrap was, quote, unwholesome and unfit for human consumption.
Mm.
He is seeking $150,000 in damages.
That's a hefty olive pit.
Well, in St. Paul, where I will be able to go out and have some walleye today, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
You enjoyed that. We'll have some tofu here in L.A. I'm All Steve Chiatakis right. on the West Coast. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.